This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey, and for the rest of the program today, we're going to be talking about the 21st Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. It ended the prohibition on the manufacture, sale, or transportation of intoxicating liquors, and it was ratified 90 years ago this month on December 5th, 1933. And joining us now to talk more about that is Taylor Pensino, who was a longtime State House reporter for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. He's also the author of numerous books on Illinois history, including Brothers Notorious, about the Sheltons, Southern Illinois' legendary gangsters, is the subtitle of that book, and Dapper and Deadly, the true story of Black Charlie Harris. Taylor Pensino, welcome to the 21st Show. Thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you, Brian. Glad to be with you. Good morning.
Good morning. And I also want to just thank the 21st Show listener in Springfield, Illinois, who came up to me and suggested this segment at the NPR Illinois Thank You Fest back in November. I unfortunately did not write down your name, but I did write down your idea. And without you, this anniversary would have completely escaped my notice. So thank you for pointing it out to me. 800-222-9455 is the number if you want to join our conversation today. That's 800-222-9455. All right, Taylor, I thought we could just begin with the background. What led America into this great experiment with prohibition in the first place?
Okay, Brian, great question. The 21st Amendment, which, as you said, was ratified in 1933, ended 90 years ago, ended the federal regulation of, or the federal prohibition of, as you said, the manufacture, sale, or transportation of alcoholic beverages. It, of course, eliminated or reversed the 18th Amendment, which was approved in 1919 and fully enforced starting in 1920. It was the 18th Amendment which imposed what we call prohibition on the sale and transportation of liquor in the country. And there's a 13-year period here, Brian, obviously between 1920 and 1933. And as far as downstate Illinois goes, our part of the world, and most of the lower half of the state, it was 13 years of gang wars, bootlegging, the Ku Klux Klan, violence, enmity everywhere, family split, terror in some places. It was an incredible period, Brian, of lawlessness in downstate Illinois.
What did prohibition mean for day-to-day life for people, right? I mean, were they drinking bathtub gin, or were most people just going dry and miserable
okay.
about it?
Well, you finally answered the question. Yeah, obviously, people did not stop drinking. And let's take places like Belleville and East St. Louis, where there are many saloons. What they did, Brian, is they changed into what they called confectionaries. And when you came in the front, you could buy, you know, bakery goods and cakes and so on. But in the back room or back rooms, you could still get booze. And that was very common. And then you mentioned bathtub gin, and that's true. Many people learned how to manufacture their own liquor in their own bathtubs. It wasn't all that complicated, really. So the bottom line is drinking never really stopped. And I like to say that prohibition was a noble social experiment that ultimately failed because it gave rise to civil disorder, chaos, and maybe most importantly, the growth of modern day organized crime. We saw that in Chicago, of course, with the Capone organization, and downstate, it was triggered and led by the notorious Shelton gang.
Yeah, and you talk about, I mean, the war, when you say conflict or fighting, it was really something. I for a different interview earlier this year about the Klan's resurgence in the early 20th century, they really were pretty violent about alcohol in some cases, although they knew not to mess with Capone in Chicago.
That's true. No, you're right. You put it very well. The Klan was reborn in mainly southern Illinois in the early 1920s. Now, to be fair, a lot of prominent citizens who wanted prohibition enforced, it wasn't being enforced, a lot of citizens who wanted it enforced were in the Klan, and that doesn't excuse the image of the Klan and all that. But the Klan was very powerful about, for about 3 or 4 years in the early 1920s, mainly down in the lower third of the state, but also in East St. Louis and Belleville, Danville, everywhere else you could imagine, the lower part of Illinois. And the Klan was set up to try to enforcement of prohibition. And in effect, the Klan was so strong at one point that it had its own army, and the army was headed by a former federal officer named S. Glenn Young, who became very famous in the early 1920s. What happened is in Prohibition, the law enforcement folks in many places, more often than not, Brian, were not really enforcing Prohibition because people wanted to drink, and that was just the way it was. And so they looked the other way. The gangsters were very skillful at paying off sheriffs, city police chiefs, judges, and so on. And as I said, it wasn't being enforced.
And the Klan rushed in to fill some of the gaps in the enforcement.
Exactly right. Yeah. The Klan rushed in like a vigilante organization.
Yeah. So I'm sorry to interrupt you. We're gonna have to take a break on the program. We will continue this conversation in about 90 seconds. We are talking about the 90th anniversary of the 21st Amendment here on the 21st Show. It was 90 years ago this month that America resumed the legal sale, manufacture, and transportation of alcohol. We're talking about that with historian and author Taylor Pensino. More after a short break. Stay with us. This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey, and we are talking about the 21st Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. It ended the prohibition on the manufacture, sale, or transportation of intoxicating liquors, and it was ratified 90 years ago this month on December 5th, 1933.
The lid is off in many places, with the downfall of prohibition being celebrated in real old-time hilarity. Yes, and by the renewal of old acquaintances, hotels and nightclubs report a real pre-war spirit among those revelers. Boy!
Joining us today for this conversation is a man known for his old-time hilarity, Taylor Pensino, who is a former journalist. He was the head of the Illinois Coal Association for many years, and he is the author, more to the point for us today, the author of numerous books on Illinois history, including Brothers Notorious, about the Shelton Gang in Southern Illinois, and Dapper and Deadly, about a former member of the Shelton Gang named Black Charlie Harris. And if you want to join our conversation today, 800-222-9455. Maybe if you are in Central or Southern Illinois, Peoria, East St. Louis, maybe you knew about some of the legends, grew up hearing some of your elders talking about the Sheltons here in Illinois and what life was like under them. And Taylor, let's talk about that. So Carl Burney Earle, what would have life been like in one of these towns where the Sheltons had significant activities?
The Sheltons had complete control, Brian, of gambling and bootlegging. Gambling, of course, then was illegal, of bootlegging and gambling in the lower two-thirds of the state. Peoria was a dividing line. Coming down to the north side of Peoria, you had the Capone organization out of Chicago, and from the south side of Peoria to the tip of the state, you had the Sheltons running things. Briefly, the Shelton gang was led by three brothers, Carl, Big Earl, and Bernie Shelton. Carl was the leader. He was a very polished individual. I should point out that none of the Sheltons went beyond grade school. They came from an in Wayne County, Illinois, but they became very, very successful gangsters. And Carl, frankly, was the best known gangster in Illinois after Al Capone, Brian. Carl was very smooth. He liked to approach things with a velvet glove. Violence was not his first choice. His brother, Big Earl, maybe didn't have any kind of education, but he knew about balance sheets and business records as much as a Harvard MBA. And then finally he had Bernie, and Bernie was the violent one. Bernie was notorious for violence. Bernie liked to shoot first and maybe talk later. And if Carl was not successful in persuading various people to go along with housing their gambling establishments and their bootlegging stills and things like that, then they would turn it over to Bernie, and Bernie was very violent. Nobody wanted to deal with Bernie. So those are the three leaders of the famous Shelton gang. There were two other brothers, but they weren't involved in the gang. And became legendary. And I grew up down in Belleville, and in the 1940s, people, that's all they talked about were the Sheltons and FDR and the St. Louis Cardinals, which are like a religion down there, and the gang wars. The Sheltons engaged in an all-out war with the Ku Klux Klan, and it's hard to believe, but towns were actually occupied by one or the other for periods of time. There were times when the Klan literally occupied Heron. There were times when the bootleggers would occupy Mount Vernon or Harrisburg or what have you. And it's very hard to believe, Brian, but public officials would just step aside. In some cases, the Klan or the Sheltons would impose their own person in the mayor's chair, in these chairs. And the shootings and the violence and the all-out war between the Klan, as I said, it was a vigilante organization, and the gangsters, it's just hard to believe the stuff that went, they just had literal shootouts in towns, and people just got out of the way.
And you say war, I mean, they're actually bombing from airplanes. I don't know what quite the era was.
Okay. After the Klan finally was defeated, okay, the Klan finally faded into the woodwork in about 1925 or 1926. What followed, though, then was an all-out, nationally publicized gang war between the Sheltons and one of their lieutenants who had gone off on his own and challenged their leadership, Charlie Berger, down in Saline County. And for about 3 or 4 months in 1926, there was a gang war between the Sheltons and the Bergers that got national attention. And of course, it's at the heart of my book, Brothers Notorious. They all had their own speakeasies and roadhouses and so on, and they would raid each other's places of business and so on. And Berger was his headquarters. He was kind of the gang lord of Saline County down in southeastern Illinois, but he sought to expand his holdings into Shelton territory. And you mentioned the bombing. On November 12th, 1926, at the heart of the gang war, the Sheltons commandeered an old two-seat Curtiss training plane from World War I and actually set off on a bombing mission of Charlie Berger's headquarters, which was like a little state park lodge near the Saline County line. And this is interesting. A pilot that they ordered at gunpoint to fly the plane, and then a Shelton bombardier sat in the second seat, and he had with him three bombs they had made the night before. The bombs consisted of dynamite sticks, nitroglycerin, baled together by baling wire. And people say, well, what happened? Well, they circled the plane over Shady Rest. That was the name of Berger's headquarters lodge. And one bomb was a complete dud. A second bomb set off a small brush fire near the headquarters, which was put out. But the third bomb hit a cockfighting pit in the rear of the Berger headquarters, and we had our first and only casualties of a bombing raid in American history. When it hit the cockfighting pit, it killed an eagle and a bulldog, and they are the only two victims that really suffered from the first and only, up to this time, bombing raid on American soil.
On the lower 48, yeah. Oh, wow. Okay. I want to share a text message we got. that is fascinating. I want to share a text message we got from a listener who said they are reminded of mine number 5 in Beneld, Illinois, supposedly one of the biggest distilleries downstate during Prohibition.
You know, that was all Shelton territory, Brian.
Exactly. Yeah. So let's skip ahead. For the sake of time, let's skip ahead to the end of Prohibition. I was reading through some of the Springfield newspapers from early December 33, when the 21st Amendment was adopted and Prohibition ended. There was an AP report in the Illinois State Journal that read, "Surprisingly to some, the 20 states whose laws permitted the sale of hard liquor after Utah, late yesterday, became the 36th to ratify repeal, they had comparatively few citizens feeling the worse today for celebrations. Throughout the country, the festivities seemed to lack the fervor some had forecast." So can you talk about the mood of the country that led to the ratification of the 21st Amendment and how it was received?
Absolutely. People who were reasonable and whatever realized that the Prohibition was not working. It was creating chaos. Frankly, there's no other way to put it. People were not going to be denied the right, the option to drink if they wanted to drink, period. So anyway, the 21st Amendment actually returned regulation of liquor back to the states. It ended the federal prohibition. And the end of prohibition actually was sought by not one but both political parties in their platforms in the 1932 election. So the groundwork was laid there for the ratification of the elimination of prohibition in the 21st Amendment. Celebrations broke out everywhere. In some places, people danced in the streets. Taverns reopened. Breweries reopened. A lot of people went back to work. Frankly, it was an economic disaster, along with being a societal disaster, and it was celebrations broke out everywhere, from major bars in Chicago, right down to bars in Alexander County and in the bottom tip of the state.
Fascinating. What happened to the Sheltons after repeal?
Great question. The Sheltons went on, and they kind of laid low in the 1930s because they had made a lot of money, and they were doing very well in their own ways, but their gangster reign was reignited in 1940 when in Peoria they were asked. I should point out that Peoria, the gangsters and racketeering in Peoria remained independent. It was not under the heel of either the Caponites or the Sheltons. Okay, the Caponites made a move to take over Peoria in 1940, and the local officials, the folks in Peoria, the gangsters, the officials, asked the Sheltons to come out of retirement and come in and rule, take over Peoria during World War II years, which they did. They would rather be under the heel of the Sheltons than under the heel of Al Capone and his people. And so the Sheltons, it was their last big hurrah in Peoria during World War II. I think in 1945, a reform mayor was elected in Peoria, and he asked Carl Shelton to call it quits. And Carl was actually living in Peoria in a big house up on Knoxville Avenue, and was getting a lot of recognition. You know, he was regarded as a leading citizen up there. And anyway, he agreed. But he went back to his extensive land holdings in southern Illinois, where he was an early developer of the oil industry, I might add. But the Shelton imprimatur still ruled all of the gambling then, which was in vogue, the illegal gambling. So anyway, the Chicago crowd asked the Sheltons to just give it all up. Carl and Bigger and Bernie did not agree. They still had hegemony over all the downstate gambling, and so the Chicago boys and the St. Louis gangsters teamed up to do the when peaceful things don't work with the gangsters, and violence follows. This is common. And so Carl Shelton was assassinated on a beautiful October morning in 1947 while riding in an open-air Jeep, a surplus World War II Army Jeep that he loved, on some of his own along some of his own farmland holdings down in Wayne County. And that was the big story of the year in 1947, Brian. The only other two big stories in downstate Illinois in 1947 were the Centralia mine disaster and the introduction of Jackie Robinson into Major League Baseball with the Brooklyn Dodgers. But along with those two major developments, the murder of Carl Shelton was the biggest story of the year in 1947. In Illinois. And then a year later, Bernie continued to try to run things. Bernie never left Peoria. He lived in Peoria. He operated a tavern on the edge of Peoria. Mm-hmm. Bernie tried to keep things going, but he wasn't as efficient as his brother Carl. But Bernie still was very stubborn, so on a very hot day, I think in July of 1948, Bernie was assassinated on the parking lot of his tavern on the outside, just a little bit outside the boundary of Peoria. And that was effectively the end of the Sheltons.
A rare gangster who gets to die peacefully in their sleep. Many attempts
were made to assassinate Big Earl, but he did eventually die peacefully in his sleep at 86 years of age.
Well, the exception proves the rule. We'll say that. Taylor Pensino, thank you so much for being with us today on the
Really
21st
enjoyed it,
show.
Brian. Glad to be with you.
Thank you so much. The books, Taylor Pensino is the author of many books, including some on Illinois politicians, former governors Dan Walker and Richard Ogilvie, as well as Senator Russell Arrington. And his books, more to the point on what we've been talking about today, are Brothers Notorious. And the other one is about Black Charlie Harris, and it's called Dapper and Deadly, the true story of Black Charlie Harris. And that is it for our time today here on the 21st show. Coming up tomorrow, we will have our regular Friday roundtables talking about what's been happening in Springfield and Peoria, including some very controversial, I'll just say racist remarks from the head of the Illinois NAACP. That have landed her in hot water. We will be talking about that as well as other topics tomorrow on the show. The 21st show is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.